McCoy. My name is Rebecca Davis, and I represent, along with Jamie Johnson, Wells Fargo North America. The issue before the court today are twofold. Does the trial court's failure to analyze and apply Wells Fargo's second cause of action, account stated, mandate reversal? And two, does the trial court's rendering of manifestly unjust findings of fact and egregiously erroneous conclusions of law mandate reversal? In keeping with Texas law, the only answer to these two issues is a resounding yes. Because this matter addresses the trial court's failure to analyze and apply Wells Fargo's account stated cause of action, and because it also addresses unjust findings of fact and erroneous conclusions of law, the standard of review to be applied is abuse of discretion. Walker v. Packer, 827 Southwest 2nd, 833, Texas Supreme Court, 1992. Issue 1, does the trial court's failure to analyze and address Wells Fargo's second cause of action, account stated, mandate reversal? In keeping with Landon v. John Paul Burgunder, Inc., 724 Southwest. A court abuses its discretion if it exercises its power of discretion by arriving at its choice in violation of applicable legal rules, principles, or criterion. An account stated cause of action applies to credit card collection suits. What is an account stated? An account stated. Because an account stated represents a manifestation of assent according to the restatement of contracts, second, and because the Texas Supreme Court has ruled since 1947 that an account stated applies to credit card claims, the question becomes, did Wells Fargo meet its burden of proof as to the account stated? In other words, did Wells Fargo establish that Peggy Blackburn had prior transactions with Wells Fargo?
And I'm assuming we played.
Yes, sir, we did. Okay. Peggy Blackburn called Wells Fargo and reported a lost credit card in order to have new cards and a new account number issued. Peggy Blackburn, by her own admissions, ran up $61,000 of debt, including cash withdrawals to the tune of $8,000, before notifying Wells Fargo, almost 2 years later, that Gil Blackburn had never even seen one single billing statement on this account. How did she do this? She called the Wells Fargo call center, and she had the billing statement address changed as the Wells Fargo call logs in the record reflect. Peggy Blackburn was the only person, again by her own admissions, that made payments on this account. The trial court made an additional finding of fact that all the charges on the account following April of 06 were made by Peggy Blackburn. Wells Fargo definitely established that Peggy Blackburn had prior transactions with Wells Fargo. The second prong, did Peggy...
She's in essence running up bills on his credit card account, not telling him about them. So that's a problem between him and her.
Actually, what he did was sir, with all respect, Justice McCoy, what Dr. Blackburn did was he canceled the original account. She found out about it. She, unbeknownst to him, called Wells Fargo, and we consider it to be fraudulently, claiming a lost credit card when it wasn't really lost. He had canceled it. And she acknowledges this from the stand. She
after the $61,000 is already run up? Before the $61,000.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And proceeds to use the credit card to the tune of $61,000, including $8,000 in cash withdrawals.
What about?
Didn't she testify that she just filled out the form necessary to obtain the credit card because she wanted to access the points system?
She did, Your Honor. Justice Walker, what she said was that someone fraudulently completed that card. Now, under an account stated, she has to prove that fraud. The burden of proof shifts to her. The only evidence you have in the record is her self-serving statement that somebody at Wells Fargo did this. She did not take one deposition to find out what brazen Wells Fargo employee would do. She did not file a counterclaim or an original proceeding because, personally, if I thought that Wells Fargo had fraudulently filled out an account card for me, I know what I would be doing. I would be down at the courthouse.
But isn't it possible that she called someone and this form is used for multiple purposes, including accessing the point system. And that's what she thought she was filling it out for, and someone at Wells Fargo got it, and I'm not saying malicious or any kind of intent, but just looked at it and thought, oh, she didn't check the box.
She actually didn't call. She said she went in person to do it, and she took the card in. And I suppose it is possible, but once again, that's her burden of proof, and she failed to prove that that is what happened.
But isn't it up to the trial court to judge the credibility of the witnesses and to make whatever findings that he deems appropriate?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. But once again, she did not prove that that is what happened, and I don't think that that is an opinion that you can render. I would certainly think that if that's what happened, wouldn't she, I mean, as a normal person, I would think, would counterclaim against Wells Fargo at least, if not file an original proceeding, because that's fraud. And she had the perfect defense to this lawsuit if that was what had happened, but she didn't do that.
How would she prove it? I mean, you don't really think she's going to take the bank employee's deposition and they're going to say, yeah,
I think
the mark.
I think she could have taken a deposition, Justice McCoy, because she claims that she didn't recognize the handwriting on the card, and she certainly could have taken a deposition and proven, of any of the employees, she could have had a handwriting expert prove that that's not her handwriting, or Dr. Blackburn's handwriting. She could have done that, but she didn't.
Well, once she goes forward and puts on some evidence of her claim,
yes, sir.
Let's say enough to survive summary judgment, it seems to me that she's got some evidence weighing the scales now, and it's now going to be your burden to disprove that. Did you call witnesses at trial and said, this isn't the handwriting of any of our employees, and no one here did this, or did you do that?
Wells Fargo's corporate representative did testify, Mr. Holloway, that there was no way on earth that any Wells Fargo employee would ever, ever, of their own volition, check a joint account holder box, period. And that was his unwavering testimony, and it was uncontroverted.
So we've got a trial judge sitting there hearing one side and the other side. And aren't we under an abuse of discretion standard, basically acting as the fact finder?
Yes, sir, you are. But I think if we look at the rest of the testimony of Ms. Blackburn, it becomes very telltale that it lacks a whole lot of merit. I think one of the most troubling aspects of her testimony is the fact that in the party's MSA, she never disclosed this debt because she wasn't quite ready for Dr. Blackburn to know about it. And the MSA is included in the record. She did not disclose this account. And I think there was a reason she didn't. She didn't want Dr. Blackburn just yet to know that the account existed. But when she was ready to dump it on him and say it was his, then she was ready for him to know about it.
Her lawyer wrote his lawyer demanding that the account that he had just closed be restored. Is that correct?
He did, Your Honor. Gary Nicholson did write that letter to Tom Vick. There's no proof that Dr. Gilburn testified that he never even saw that letter and he never even knew about it. And all of the Wells Fargo call logs indicate that she called, reported a lost card, got a new account number. There is no record whatsoever in those call logs that Dr. Blackburn ever called Wells Fargo and reinstated that account. It was solely Peggy Blackburn for almost two years that ran up this account, which she testified that those were her expenses, that she needed. She only used the card when she needed it, and she needed it for her daughter's $50,000 wedding. It is baffling.
Well, I mean, that Wells Fargo has a procedure that would allow that to happen.
She had already been designated in 2003, Justice McCoy, as a joint account holder.
Another account.
Correct. That's why she was allowed to call in and say, whoops, we lost it, we need a new one, because she was an authorized joint holder.
It's a different account, right? She has a new account number.
Correct. Well, up until then, she and Dr. Blackburn had been very good customers of Wells Fargo. She knew that those billing statements would go straight to her and not to Dr. Blackburn. She had no intentions of those billing statements to go to Dr. Blackburn.
The new account had him and her on it, or just her?
Oh, it had both of them.
Oh, I see.
That's why Wells Fargo sued Dr. Blackburn as well.
I see.
It had both of them on it.
I see. Okay.
Additionally, Texas law, as well as federal law, holds that the use of a credit card creates a loan and an obligation to repay that loan. Did Peggy Blackburn prove fraud? She absolutely did not. She only offered her own self-serving statement, stating that someone had filled in the form after she turned it in. Mr. Holloway, Wells Fargo's corporate representative, said that under no film, form, or fashion would that happen, and he was adamant in his testimony. Peggy Blackburn's testimony is totally without merit. And again, I think the failure to divulge this account in the MSA is very telltale of her actions.
But we're not here to judge her credibility. That's what the trial court does. We're just here to look at an abuse of discretion. And if the trial court chose to believe her, then I think you need to show us why that decision to believe her was an abuse of discretion.
And that's what I intend to do, Justice Dauphineau, when I get into the findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Got to get moving because your time's...
Issue 2, the trial court's rendering of manifestly unjust findings of fact and conclusions of law mandate reversal of this issue. The evidence presented to the trial court by Peggy Blackburn was so weak and the findings of fact were so against the weight and preponderance of the evidence, the trial court's ruling was wrong and manifestly unjust. Obviously, I do not have time to address all the findings of fact. However, Wells Fargo does specifically take issue with findings 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 13, 15, 17, 18, 19, 20, and 23. I will address each of these findings with as much time as I have left. Finding of fact 7. Wells Fargo admitted that Peggy Blackburn was not personally liable for the charges on the account. Nowhere in the record does Wells Fargo admit that Peggy Blackburn is not personally liable, nor does Peggy Blackburn refer this court to any citation in that record where Wells Fargo made such an alleged admission. It is interesting to note, however, in the record how many times opposing counsel attempted to put these words into the mouth of Wells Fargo's corporate representative.
I think it's on Exhibit Tab 4 of the Appellee's brief. It's in the Wells Fargo notes. Referred to Kim since we need to find out how she became a secondary account holder instead of just signer, which was her role. She was just a signer on account before it was closed.
That's correct. And the rest of
that's some evidence.
Well, but the rest of the calls then go on to state that she is a joint account holder and she was told that repeatedly by the call center.
But you're saying that that finding of fact that she was never responsible on the counter, that Wells Fargo admitted she wasn't responsible on the count, was not supported by any evidence, and this would seem to be evidence supporting that finding of fact.
Well, actually, I read that as a possibility. What it says is we need to find out how. It doesn't say she's not, or she never was, or she is. It simply says we need to confirm whether she is or not.
It says we need to find out how she became
correct
secondary account holder instead of just signer.
Correct.
Her role on account before it was closed 3-6. So I'm just saying I think that that is in the record and that that supports the finding of fact number 7.
Okay. Finding of fact number 8. Peggy signed an extra benefit form solely for the purpose of accessing the extra benefits. Logic dictates that if Peggy Blackburn suspected Wells Fargo had committed fraud and had, of its own volition, made her a joint account holder, Peggy Blackburn would have sought legal recourse. She did not. However, Dr. Blackburn did. He countersued Wells Fargo for breach of contract, common law fraud, and promissory estoppel. Then and only then did Peggy Blackburn notify Wells Fargo that the billing statements should be sent to Gil Blackburn and not to Peggy Blackburn. And if this was her sole purpose for applying for the new credit card, then why was this account not disclosed? Finding of fact number 10, Peggy Blackburn did not manifest an intent to personally be liable on this account. What greater manifestation can you have than the two letters sent by Peggy Blackburn to Wells Fargo? What greater manifestation can you have than admitting from the stand, I only used the card when I needed it, and it was needed for my daughter's $50,000 wedding? Texas law holds that if you use a credit card, you manifest intent. Finding of fact number 11.
What about the notice on that same document that Justice Walker referred to? Court has document to support cardholder one had to keep at account open for her to use while divorce proceedings were happening.
That is where she's claiming the letter from Gary Nicholson to Tom Vick, Justice Dauphineau. And Dr. Blackburn testified that he had never seen that letter, and there was no proof that that's what happened. And when you look at the Wells Fargo call logs, which are part of the record, there is no indication whatsoever that he ever called back and opened that account again. I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Michael Moore on behalf of Peggy Blackburn. This case was tried before Judge Quisenberry in Parker County. It's a bench trial, non-jury trial with findings of fact. I submit that the standard of review in this case is whether the findings are against a great weight and preponderance of the evidence. It's not an abusive discretion standard. It's a factual insufficiency standard with specific findings of fact. So it's their job to show manifest, unjust findings that are clear or clearly demonstrate bias by the trial court. I believe this is a unique case under the law because it involves concepts of credit card industry standards that are not typically seen in the reported Court of Appeals decisions. There's lots of Court of Appeals decisions talking about credit card cases and collections. And unfortunately, the way the economy is going these days, there's going to be more cases. But this case involved the concept of an authorized user versus a joint account holder. And at trial, Wells Fargo admitted that when the account was originally set up in March of 2002, Peggy Blackburn was only an authorized user of the account without having personal liability. And that's what they pled in the case, though, that she was a joint account holder from the beginning when the account was opened in March of 2002. But at trial, the evidence showed that she was not liable on the account when it was opened in March of 2002. So they had to come forward at trial with some evidence that something changed after the account was opened to make her personally liable for charges on the account. And the evidence that they relied upon trial was the extra benefits form, which is under tab, I believe, tab 3 of our brief.
Now, didn't her husband call in and cancel the account that you're talking about?
I'm sorry?
Didn't her husband cancel the account that you're talking about originally, the one in 2002?
That was in 2006. He canceled the account.
The one that started in 2002, he canceled it.
In 2006.
Well,
there was evidence at trial that the new account was just a vehicle to accept the small balance that was due on the original account. So I think the case was tried under the concept that really, even though they're two different account numbers, they're one and the same. That's the way I believe the case was tried at the trial court level. So what I'm saying, though, is that the Wells Fargo contended at trial. They didn't plead this, but they contended at trial that in March and December of 2003, about 16 months after the account had been opened, Peggy signed this extra benefits form that made her a joint account holder and thus personally liable for charges on the account from that day forward, December of 2003. Peggy's testimony at trial was that, no, I did not intend to become a joint account holder by signing that form. I signed that form in blank to access the rewards benefit program that my husband didn't sign up for when he opened the account. They wanted discount airfare. So the bank said, no problem, just sign this form. Because it's a multi-use form, it can be used for multiple purposes. She signed the form in blank. The bank told her, the bank took it, tried to put them in the rewards benefit program, and she said, oh, I'm sorry, this is your husband's account. You're not authorized to make changes on this account. You need to take this form, have your husband sign it, then he can bring it back to the bank, and then we will put you in the rewards benefit program. She did that, and that's the last she knew of that. What happened was when Gil Blackburn returned the form back to the bank, Wells Fargo completed the form. So it was not completed by Peggy. And the trial testimony from Gil Blackburn, it was not completed by him. The only two things that were completed on that form by the Blackburns were their signature. Everything else was completed by Wells Fargo. And even Mr. Blackburn said he did not recognize any of the printed writing on the form. The only thing he recognized was his wife's signature and his signature. So that was the primary issue before the trial court. What was the legal effect of this form on this case? Did it create primary liability on Peggy Blackburn's, did it create personal liability for her? And the trial court very specifically found that by signing that form, she did not intend to become personally liable. The trial court found that it was filled in blank. She signed it only to access the rewards benefit program. So even though they say, well, we had the burden of proof, it was our position at trial that Wells Fargo had the burden of proof to show that it had an enforceable agreement, expressed or implied, with Peggy Blackburn that she would be obligated to repay the debt. That's very simple contract law in Texas, is that it's their burden to show they had an agreement that she was personally to be personally liable on the debt. And it was our position at trial that they completely failed in that regard. Definitely, there's not any kind of indication here that those findings by the trial court were against a great weight and preponderance of the evidence, which is the standard in this case. And counsel here today says, well, if the extra benefit form was signed under those circumstances, well, that would be fraud. Peggy would have sued the bank. All of that type of argument is pure speculation. And it's really an attempt to shift the burden of proof from the plaintiff to prove their case to the defendant to defend the case. And it's an attempt to shift the burden of proof, which is not, permissible in this situation. So not only that, but, and I won't bore the court with it all set out in the brief, but even if there was an agreement, under existing case law, Wells Fargo failed to prove the material terms of that agreement. They relied upon a card member agreement, which was stamped, I believe, in April of 2008. And there was no proof at trial linking that 2008 agreement to any time prior to that, either in 2002 when the account was opened or 2003 when Peggy allegedly became personally liable. And the concept under the law is that you have to prove not only that you had an agreement, but you have to prove the material terms of the agreement. So they didn't prove any material terms of any agreement that they contended existed. And with respect, for example, with respect to the interest that was charged on the account, you look at the card member agreement, it says you have to look at the supplemental disclosures to see what is authorized to be charged. Wells Fargo at trial never produced any supplemental disclosures to justify the charge of interest or finances charges on the account. Their position at trial was, well, the interest rate is set forth in the monthly statement that the debtors received every month, the debtor received. And there is a case that allows that. But this case is distinguishable because I think it was the Hinojosa case that stated the card member agreement said that the interest rate would be set forth on the monthly statement sent to you. This card member agreement that's an issue in this case doesn't say that. It says you have to look at the supplemental disclosures. There was at least briefed some alleged pleading deficiency arguments that they said, well, we should have had the duty to either bring forth some affirmative defenses under Rule 94 or verified denials under 93. And I haven't heard any argument about those. I guess it was a wave. But the point that I want to make with respect real briefly with that is that they contend that we should have denied things that they didn't plead. They never pled that Peggy was a joint account holder. They never pled that she became liable by signing the extra benefits form in December of 2003. Those are things that are completely out of the pleadings. And those are the things that they contend we should have filed either affirmative defenses or verified denials to. Just briefly, the evidence, they repeatedly say that Peggy called to report the card as lost or stolen in 2006. That's not the evidence. Evidence is that Peggy called and complained about it, and they said that Wells Fargo told Peggy, well, you're going to have to get your husband to reopen the account or reinstate the account, and that's why she called her divorce lawyer. And he called the other divorce lawyer, and somehow the account got set up or reinstated. So there's no evidence that Peggy called in, or at least from Peggy's standpoint, there's no evidence that she called in and called the or reported the card as lost or stolen. References, we should have taken depositions or filed counterclaims. That's, again, I think, an effort to try to shift the burden of proof. It was their burden to prove their case, and by trying to say that we should have filed counterclaims for fraud or whatever is just an attempt to say, since we didn't do that, we must be wrong. We must be liable. Well, that's an attempt to shift the burden of proof. The mediated settlement agreement respectfully has no issue to this case. This case is between a creditor and a debtor. It's not a husband and wife case. It's not a divorce case. It has no application. None of the divorce proceedings really have any application to this case. Mr. Holloway's testimony is that what his actual testimony is that he, with regard to the extra benefits form, he first testified that it had to have been, it was not filled out by a Wells Fargo representative. It had to have been either filled out by Peggy or Gil Blackburn. That's what his first testimony was. But on further cross-examination, he admitted he had no personal knowledge of who completed the form. So there's a complete lack of credibility to his testimony. But then couple that with the fact, Peggy's testimony that she didn't fill the form out, and Gil Blackburn's testimony, he didn't fill the form out. The only one else to fill the form out was Wells Fargo. So I submit that Mr. Holloway's testimony on behalf of Wells Fargo was completely unreliable, and I think that's what the way the trial court felt, too, on the case. And the earlier question, where there were a number of computer records admitted at trial from Wells Fargo that had entries that completely conflicted with their position on the case. We've talked about July 1607 record where it says we need to find out how she became a secondary account holder instead of just a signer, which was her role. There's also another one in December of 2007 where it says account is under primary and authorized user. This is December of 2007 after the charges, all the $60,000 had been incurred. All of it had already been incurred. And here's Wells Fargo saying account is under primary and authorized user, which is what it was set up for in March of 2002. So Wells Fargo's own records that were introduced in this case conflicted with their side, with their theory before the trial court. So having said that, the trial court clearly made judgments based upon the credibility and the weight of the evidence, and under the standard we're here today with being a great weight and preponderance, I fail to see how anyone can feel that there's any merit to Wells Fargo appeal on this case. I really do. I believe that's all I have now. Thank you.
Mr. Rebuttal.
Mr. Moore complains and states that Wells Fargo failed to provide the disclosure statements, that there was no proof whatsoever at trial. To the contrary, Mr. Holloway testified time and time again to Mr. Moore that the terms and the disclosures went out with the new credit card and they were sent to Peggy Blackburn. That was his testimony, and he did not ever waver from that testimony. Mr. Moore then complains about no knowledge of interest rates. Here again, with all due respect, Mr. Holloway tried to explain this at trial, and he said, if you have a variable account, which if I'm not mistaken, I believe the Hinojosa case was a variable account, but I'm not positive. What Mr. Holloway testified was that if you do not have a variable account, you do not get supplemental disclosures. And if you will look at every single billing statement in the record, it shows you exactly what the interest rates were, exactly what they are now, and that was what Mr. Holloway's testimony was. Peggy Blackburn knew what the interest rates were. Mr. Moore argued that we never pled that Peggy was a joint account holder. If I'm not mistaken, the original petition refers to the Blackburns as joint. Mr. Holloway did testify that the card was lost, and that's why the new one was reissued. And then she called her lawyer after she reported the card lost. Mr. Holloway's testimony, the record when he states he has no knowledge who filled out the card, to me the record reads as he's not sure which employee filled out the card because he did not waver from his context of a Wells Fargo employee would not have done that. Mr. Moore further argues that in December of 2007, it still lists Peggy as the, it still lists in the call log, the primary and the authorized user. And again, with all due respect, Mr. Holloway tried to explain to Mr. Moore at trial that he is misusing those two terms. Primary and authorized can be used together, and they can be used to describe one cardholder, whether they're joint or not. And that was the explanation given at trial. As to the conclusions of law, it is Wells Fargo's position that Gil Blackburn did not have a contract as to the new account, which was acquired solely by Peggy Blackburn, and as is dictated by Texas's law of contracts relative to credit cards and Texas's law of relative to accounts stated. Gil Blackburn terminated his contract with Wells Fargo in March of 2006. Peggy Blackburn knew that. Peggy Blackburn went and acquired another contract with Wells Fargo. That's what all the testimony shows, even Peggy Blackburn's testimony. Peggy Blackburn did have a contract with Wells Fargo in terms of federal law and Texas law. She acknowledged that she was a joint account holder in her letter to Wells Fargo. She acknowledged that she was making the payments on the account. She acknowledged that she secured that new contract with Wells Fargo. Because the trial court's renderings of findings of fact were egregiously unjust and because the conclusions of law were erroneous, Wells Fargo prays that this matter be reversed.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted. This court will be adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.